An A, anyway. Well, funnily enough, a pool of vomit is not the ideal place to get DNA. Surface cells from the mucous membranes are scattered when there is such volume, and under the open sky, they are exposed to pollution from innumerable other DNA sources. I know all that. But at least we have something to go on now. What are you doing at the moment? Beata sighed. I received a strange text message from the Veterinary Institute, and have to call and find out what they mean. The Veterinary Institute? Yes. We found some half-digested meat in the vomit, so we sent it for DNA analysis. The idea was they would check it against the meat archive that the Agricultural High School in Oss uses to trace meat to its place of origin and the producer. If it has any special qualities, maybe we can link it to a restaurant in Oslo. It's a shot in the dark. But if Stankich has found a place to hide in the last 24 hours, he must be moving as little as possible. And if he has eaten somewhere close by, it's probable he would go there again. Well, why not? What was the text message? In which case it must be a Chinese restaurant. Bit cryptic. Call back when you know any more. And... yes? Harry could hear that what he was going to say would sound ridiculous. Halvorsen was strong. They could do the most extraordinary things nowadays and everything would be fine. Nothing. After Beata had hung up, Harry addressed himself to the table and the bottles. Eeny, meeny. Mo was the bottle of Johnny Walker. Harry held the miniature with one hand and unscrewed, or, to be more precise, twisted the top with the other. He felt like Gulliver, trapped in a foreign land with pygmy bottles. He breathed in the familiar sweet smell from the narrow opening. It was just a mouthful, but his body was already alarmed by the prospect of a toxic attack and was on full alert. Harry dreaded the inevitable first fit of puking, but knew this would not stop him. On the TV, Knut Hamsun said he was tired and could not write any more. Harry inhaled as though preparing for a long and deep dive. The telephone rang. Harry hesitated. The telephone went quiet after one ring. He was raising the bottle when the telephone rang again, and went quiet. He realized they were calling from reception. He put the bottle down on the bedside table and waited. When there was a third ring, he picked up the receiver. "Mr. Hansen?" "Yes." "There is somebody in the lobby for you." Harry stared at the gentleman in the red jacket on the label. "Say I'm on my way."
"Yes, sir."
Harry held the bottle with three fingers. Then he leaned back and emptied the contents down his throat. 4 seconds later, he was bent over the toilet bowl, throwing up his airline lunch. The receptionist pointed to the cluster of furniture by the piano, where a small, grey-haired woman with a shawl over her shoulders was sitting erect in a chair. She observed Harry with calm brown eyes as he walked toward her. He stopped in front of the table on which there was a small battery-powered radio. Excited voices were commenting on a sports event, perhaps a soccer match. The sound merged with a potpourri of classic film Muzak-type tunes that the pianist behind her was concocting as his fingers glided across the keys.
"Dr. Zhivago," she said in English, with a nod in the direction of the pianist. "Nice, isn't it, Mr. Hansen?"
Her pronunciation and intonation were precise. She smirked as if she had said something amusing, and signaled with a discreet but firm flick of the hand that he should sit down.
"Do you like music?" Harry asked. "Doesn't everyone? I used to teach music."
She leaned forward and turned up the volume of the radio.
"Are you afraid that we're being monitored?"
She sat back in her chair.
"What do you want, Hansen?"
Harry repeated the story of his son and the man outside the school, while the bile burned in his throat and the pack of hounds in his stomach snapped and howled for more.
"How did you find me?" she asked.
"I was tipped off by a person from Vukovar."
"Where do you come from?"
Harry swallowed. His tongue felt dry and swollen.
"Copenhagen."
She studied him. Harry waited. He felt a drop of sweat roll down between his shoulder blades, and another forming on his top lip. To hell with this. He needed his medicine. Now.
"I don't believe you,"
she said at length. "Okay," Harry said, getting up. "I have to go."
"Wait."
The small woman's voice was firm, and she motioned for him to sit down again. "This does not mean that I don't have eyes in my head," she said. Harry sat down.
"I can see hatred," she said, "and grief.
and I can smell booze. I believe the bit about your dead son. She evinced a brief smile. What is it you want done? Harry tried to collect himself. How much does it cost, and how quickly can it be done? That depends. But you won't find any professional operatives more reasonable than us. We start at 5,000 euros plus expenses.
Okay. Next week?
That may be rather short notice.
The woman had hesitated for only a fraction of a second, but it had been enough. Enough for him to know. And now he could see that she knew he knew. The voices on the radio were screaming with excitement, and the crowd in the background was cheering. Someone had scored.
You're not sure your operative will return in time? Harry said. She looked at him long and hard.
You're still a policeman, aren't you?
Harry nodded. I'm an inspector in Oslo. The skin around her eyes recoiled. But I'm no danger to you, Harry said. Croatia is not under my jurisdiction, and no one knows I'm here. Neither the Croatian police nor my own bosses.
So what do you want?
To strike a deal.
About what?
She leaned across the table and turned down the volume on the radio.
Your operative in exchange for my target.
What do you mean?
A swap.
Your man for John Carson. If he gives up his hunt for Carson, we'll let him go. She raised an eyebrow.
All of you protecting one man against an operative, Mr. Henson? And you're frightened?
We're frightened of a bloodbath. Your operative has already taken the lives of two people and stabbed one of my colleagues. She paused.
That can't be right.
There will be more dead bodies if you don't call him back, and one of them will be his. She closed her eyes, sat like that for some time. Then she breathed in.
If he's killed one of your colleagues, you'll be out for revenge. How can I rely on you to keep your part of the deal?
My name's Harry Hole. He placed his passport on the table. If it comes out that I've been here without permission from the Croatian authorities, there will be a diplomatic incident, and I'll be without a job. She produced a pair of glasses.
So you're putting yourself forward as a hostage? Do you think that sounds credible, Mr.?
She placed the glasses on her nose and read the passport.
Harry Hull?
That's my stake in the deal. She nodded.
I understand. And do you know what?
She took off her glasses. I might have been willing to do a deal. But what good is it if I can't call him back?
What do you mean?
I don't know where he is. Harry studied her, saw the pain in her eyes, heard the tremor in her voice.
Well, Harry said, you'll have to negotiate with what you have. Give me the name of the person who contracted the murder.
No. If the policeman dies, Harry said, taking a photograph from his pocket and placing it on the table between them, the chances are that your operative will be killed. It may well be made to look as if the policeman was forced to shoot in self-defense. That's the way it is. Unless I prevent it. Do you understand? Is this the person?
Threats don't work very well with me, Mr. Holt.
I'm going back to Oslo early tomorrow morning. I'll write my telephone number on the back of the photo. Call me if you change your mind. She took the photograph and put it in her bag. Harry spoke in a hurried whisper.
It's your son, isn't it?
She stiffened.
What makes you think that?
I have eyes in my head, too. I can also see pain. She sat hunched over her bag.
And what about you, Hole?
She raised her eyes and looked into his face.
Is this policeman one you don't know? Since you can forgo revenge so easily?
Harry's mouth was so dry that his breath burned inside.
Yes, he said. I don't know him.
Harry thought he could hear a cock crowing as, through the window, he watched her walk away on the opposite side of the road until she turned left and disappeared from view. In his room, he drained the rest of the miniatures, vomited again, drank beer, vomited, looked at himself in the mirror, and took the elevator down to the bar. 23. Friday night, December 19th. The dogs. He sat in the dark container trying to think. The policeman's wallet contained 2,800 Norwegian kroner, and if he remembered the exchange rate correctly, that meant he had enough for food, a new jacket, and a plane ticket to Copenhagen. The problem now was ammunition. The shotgun Göteborgata had been the seventh and the last. He had been down to Plata and inquired where he could buy 9mm bullets, but had received blank looks in reply. If he kept on asking random faces, the odds of him bumping into an undercover cop were pretty high. He smacked his empty Lama Minimax down on the floor. A man smiled up at him from the ID card. Halvorsen. They were bound to have formed a protective cordon around John Carlson now. There was just one possibility left, a Trojan horse. And he knew who the horse would have to be. Harry Hall. Number 5, Sophia Skata, according to the woman at directory assistance, who told him there was only one Harry Hall in Oslo. He checked his watch and froze. There was the sound of footsteps outside. He jumped up, grabbed the chunk of glass with one hand and the gun with the other, and stood beside the opening. The door opened. He saw a silhouette against the lights of the town. Then the figure came in and sat down on the floor with crossed legs. He held his breath. Nothing happened. Then there was the hiss of a match, and the corner and the face of the intruder were lit up. He was holding a teaspoon in the same hand as the match. With the other hand and his teeth, he tore open a plastic bag. He recognized the boy in the light blue denim jacket. As he breathed out with relief, the boy's swift, effective movements came to a sudden halt. Hello? The boy peered into the dark while stashing away the bag in his pocket. He cleared his throat and stepped into the outer circle of light from the match. Remember me? The boy stared at him in terror. I talked to you outside the railway station. I gave you money. Your name's Christopher, isn't it? Christopher gaped. Is that you? The foreigner who gave me 500 kroner. Christ. Well, okay, I recognize your voice. Ow! Christopher dropped the match, which went out on the floor. His voice sounded closer in the pitch darkness. Is it all right if I share this place with you tonight, pal? You can have it all to yourself. I was on my way out. Another match flickered into life. Better if you stay here. Warmer with two. I mean it, man. He was holding a spoon and filling it with liquid from a small bottle. What's that? Water and ascorbic acid. Christopher opened the bag and poured the powder into the spoon without contaminating a single grain, then deftly moved the match into the other hand. You're good at it, Christopher. He watched the junkie hold the flame under the teaspoon while flipping out another match and holding it ready. They call me Steady Hand in Plata. I can see why. Listen, I've got to be going. Let's change jackets and you might survive the night. Christopher looked first at his thin denim jacket and then at the other man's thick blue one. Wow. Do you mean that? Yes, of course. Shit, that's kind of you. Hang on until I fix this shot. Could you hold the match? Wouldn't it be easier if I held the syringe? Christopher scowled at him. Hello. I may be green, but I'm not falling for the oldest junkie trick in the world. Come on, hold the match. He took the match. The powder dissolved in the water and became a clear brown liquid, and Christopher put a cotton ball in the spoon. To get rid of the crap, he answered, before the other asked, then sucked the liquid up into the syringe through the cotton ball and placed the tip against his arm. Can you see how wonderful my skin is? Hardly a mark. Can you see that? Wonderful thick veins. Pure virgin territory, they say. But in a couple of years it will be yellow with inflamed scabs like theirs. And no more steady hand either. I know that, but I still keep doing it. Crazy or what? While Christopher was talking, he shook the syringe to cool the liquid. He had tightened a rubber strap around his upper arm, inserted the needle into the vein that wound like a blue snake under his skin. The metal slid through the skin. Then he injected the heroin into his bloodstream. His eyelids half closed and his mouth half opened. Then his head fell back and his eyes found the hovering dog's corpse. He watched Christopher for a while. Then he threw away the burned match and unzipped the blue jacket. When Beata Lern did get through at last, she could hardly hear Harry because of the disco version of Jingle Bells reverberating in the background. But she heard enough to know that he was not sober. Not because his speech was slurred. Quite the contrary, he was very articulate. She told them about Halvorsen. Cardiac tamponade, Harry shouted. Internal bleeding that fills the area around the heart so that it can't beat properly. They had to drain a lot of blood. The situation has stabilized now, but he's still in a coma. We just have to wait. I'll call you if there are any developments.
Thanks. Anything else I ought to know? Hagen sent John Carlson and Thea Nielsen back to Østgård with two babysitters, and I spoke to Sofia Miholjic's mother. She promised to take Sofia to a doctor today. What about the Veterinary Institute report about the meat in the vomit? They said they suggested Chinese restaurants, because China is the only country in the world where they eat that kind of thing. Eat what kind of thing? Dog. Dog. Hold on. The music was gone, and in its place she heard traffic noise. Then Harry's voice was there again. But they don't serve dog meat in Norway, for Christ's sake. No, this is special. The Veterinary Institute managed to pinpoint the breed, so I'll call the Norwegian Kennel Club tomorrow. They have a database of all pedigreed dogs and their owners. I don't quite see how that will help us. There must be hundreds of thousands of dogs in Norway. 400,000. At least one for every household. I've checked it. The point is that this one is rare. Have you ever heard of a black Metzner? Please repeat that. She repeated, and for a couple of seconds all she heard was the traffic noise in Zagreb, until Harry shouted, "Of course. That makes sense. A man looking for shelter. Why didn't I think of that before?" "Think of what?" "I know where Stankic is hiding." "What?" "You must get hold of Hagen and have him authorize an armed operation by special forces."
"Where? What are you talking about?"
"The container terminal. Stankic is hiding in one of the containers."
"How do you know that?"
"Because there aren't many fucking places in Oslo where you can eat black Metzner. Make sure special forces and Falkeit have surrounded the terminal by the time I arrive on the first plane tomorrow, but no arrests before I get there. Is that clear?"
After Beata hung up, Harry stood in the street looking at the hotel bar, where the plastic music was pounding away, and the half-finished glass of poison was awaiting him. He had him now, the mali spasite. All that was needed was a clear head and a steady hand. Harry thought about Halvorsen, of a heart drowning in blood. He could go straight up to his room, where there was no more alcohol, lock the door and throw the key out the window, or he could go in and finish off his drink. Harry shivered and took a deep breath and switched off his cell. Then he went into the bar. The staff at the Salvation Army's headquarters had long since switched off the lights and gone home, but the light in Martina's office was still on. She dialed Harry Hole's number while asking herself the same questions. Was it because he was older that it was so exciting, or because there seemed to be so many repressed emotions, or because he looked so helpless? The incident where Harry snubbed the woman outside his flat should have frightened her off, but for some reason or other the opposite was the case. She had become more intent than ever to... Yes. What did she want, actually? Martina groaned when the voice announced that the person she was calling either had switched the phone off or was in an area with poor coverage. She called directory assistance, got the number of his landline on Sofia's gata, and called. Her heart leapt when she heard his voice, but it was only an answering machine. She had the perfect excuse for popping by on her way home from the office, and now he wasn't there. She left another message, saying she had to give him the ticket for the Christmas concert in advance, because she would be helping at the concert hall from the morning onward. She put down the phone and, at that moment, became aware that someone was standing in the doorway observing her.
"Rikard, don't do that. You frightened me."
"Sorry. I was on my way home and just poked my head in to see if I was the last one here. Can I drive you home?"
"Thank you, but you've got your jacket on.
Come on. And then you don't have to bother with the alarm." Rikard laughed his staccato laugh. Martina had managed to set off the new alarm twice last week when she had been last to leave, and they'd had to pay the security company to come out.
"Okay," she said. "Thank you."
"Not at all," Rikard sniffled. His heart was pounding. He could smell Harry Hole now. With infinite care, he opened the door and groped for the light switch on the wall. In his other hand, he held the gun, pointing it at the bed he could more or less make out in the dark. He breathed in and flicked the light switch. The bedroom was flooded in light. The room was bare, just a basic bed, which was tidy and unoccupied, like the rest of the flat. He had already searched the other rooms, and now he was in the bedroom and could feel his pulse beginning to calm down. Harry Hole was not at home. He put his gun in the pocket of the filthy denim jacket
and felt it crush the urinal block he had taken from the bathroom in Oslo Central Station, which was next to the public telephone he had used to find out Hole's Sofia's Gata address. It had been easier to enter the building than he had thought. After ringing twice at the main door, without receiving an answer, he had been about to give up. But then he pushed the door, and although it was closed, it had not snapped shut. Must have been the cold. On the third floor, Hole's name was scribbled on a strip of masking tape. He had put his cap against the glass pane above the lock and hit it with the barrel of his gun. It had yielded with a crisp crack. The sitting room faced the backyard, so he took the risk of switching on a lamp. He looked around. Simple and Spartan. Tidy. But his Trojan horse, the man who could lead him to John Carlson, was not there, for the time being. But he hoped he had a weapon or ammunition. He started with the places it would be natural to imagine a policeman might keep a gun, in drawers or cupboards or under the pillow. On finding nothing, he carried out a systematic room-to-room search, but without any success. Then he began the random search that is manifest proof that you have, in fact, given up and are desperate. Under a letter on the telephone table, he found a police ID card with a photo of Harry Hole. He pocketed it. He moved books and records, which he noticed were arranged in alphabetical order on the shelves. There was a stack of papers on the coffee table. He flicked through them and stopped at a photograph with a motif he had seen in many variants. Dead man in a uniform. Robert Carlson. He saw the name Stunkage. One form had Harry's name at the top. His eyes ran down it and stopped at a check mark by a familiar expression. Smith & Wesson, 38. The signatory had written his name with grandiose flourishes. A gun license? A request form? He gave up. So Harry Hole had the gun on him. He went into the cramped but clean bathroom and turned on the tap. The hot water made him tremble. The soot from his face turned the sink black. Then he turned on the cold tap, and the coagulated blood on his hands dissolved, and the sink went red. He dried himself and opened the cabinet above the sink, found a roll of gauze, which he tied around his hand and the wound from the glass. There was something missing. He saw a short bristle beside the tap, as if after a shave, but there was no razor, no shaving foam, or a toothbrush, toothpaste, or a toiletry bag. Was Hole away, in the middle of a murder investigation? Or perhaps he lived with a girlfriend? In the kitchen, he opened the fridge, which contained a milk carton with a sell-by date 6 days away, a jar of jam, white cheese, 3 containers of stew, and a freezer compartment with sliced rye bread in a plastic wrapper. He took the milk, the bread, 2 of the containers, and switched on the stove. There was a newspaper with today's date lying beside the toaster. Fresh milk, latest newspaper. He began to lean toward the travel theory. He had taken a glass from the high wall cupboard and was about to pour some milk when a sound made him drop the carton on the floor. The telephone. He watched the milk spread across the red terracotta tiles while listening to the insistent ringing in the hall. 3 mechanical clicks, followed 5 beeps, and a woman's voice filled the room. The words came fast and the tone seemed cheerful. She laughed, then put down the phone. There was something about that voice. He placed the opened cans of stew in the hot frying pan, as they had done during the siege. Not because they didn't have plates, but so that everyone knew they had equal portions. Then he went into the hall. The small black answering machine was flashing red and showed a number 2. He pressed play. The tape started. "Raquel," a woman's voice said. She sounded a little older than the one who had just spoken. After a couple of sentences, she handed the phone over to a boy, who excitedly chatted away. Then the last message came again, and he knew for certain he had not been imagining that he had heard the voice before. It was the girl on the white bus. When the messages were finished, he stood looking at the 2 color photographs stuck to the wall under the mirror. In one, Hole, a dark-haired woman and a boy, were standing on skis in the snow, squinting at the camera. The other was faded and old, and showed a small girl and boy, both in bathing suits. She seemed to have Down syndrome. He was Harry Hole. He sat in the kitchen, eating at his leisure and listening to the sounds in the stairwell. The glass pane was patched up with the transparent tape he found in the drawer of the telephone table. After eating, he went to the bedroom. It was cold. He sat on the bed and ran a hand over the soft sheets, smelled the pillow, opened the closet. He found a pair of grey boxer shorts and a folded white T-shirt with a drawing of a kind of eight-armed Shiva with the word Fritzt underneath and Joka and Valentinerna above. The clothes smelled of soap. He undressed and put them on, lay down on the bed, closed his eyes, thought of the photograph of Hohl, of Georgi, put the gun under the pillow. Even though he was absolutely exhausted, he could feel an erection on the way. His dick pressed against the tight-fitting but soft cotton, and he went to sleep in the secure knowledge that he would wake up if anyone opened the front door. Expect the unexpected. That was the motto of Sivert Falkeit, the leader of Delta, the police special forces unit. Falkeit stood on a ridge behind the container, holding a walkie-talkie, his ears full of the roar of taxis, cars and trucks heading home for Christmas on the highway. Beside him stood P.O.B. Gunnar Hagen, with the collar of his green flak jacket turned up. Falkite's boys were in the cold, ice-bound darkness beneath them. He checked his watch. 5 to 3. It was 19 minutes since one of the dog patrol's German shepherds had indicated that a person was inside a red container. Nevertheless, Falkite did not like the situation, even though the task seemed easy enough. So far, everything had gone like clockwork. It had taken a mere 45 minutes from the time he received Hagen's call for the 5 selected soldiers to appear primed and ready at the police station. Delta consisted of 70 people, mostly highly motivated, well-trained men with an average age of 31. Details were drawn up according to need, and their spheres of activity included so-called difficult armed actions, the category into which this job fell. In addition to the 5 men from Delta, there was one person from FSK, Volkswaffe Spezialkommando, the military special forces. And this was where his misgivings began. The man was an ace marksman, personally drafted in by Gunnar Hagen. He called himself Aaron, but Falkeit knew that no one in FSK operated under his real name. In fact, the whole force had been secret since its inception in 1981. And it was only during the famous Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan that the media had managed to get hold of any specific details at all about this crack unit, which, in Falkite's opinion, was more reminiscent of a secret brotherhood. "Because I trust Aaron," had been Hagen's brief explanation to Falkite. "Do you recall the rifle shot in Torp in 94? Falkite remembered the hostage drama at Torp airfield very well. He had been there. No one was told afterward who had fired the shot that saved the day, but the bullet had gone through the armpit of a bulletproof vest, hanging in front of the car window and into the bank robber's head, which had then exploded like a pumpkin in the back seat of a brand new Volvo, which the car dealer took back, washed, and resold. That wasn't what bothered him, nor that Aaron was carrying a rifle that Falkite had not seen before. The letters M.A.R. on the gun stock did not mean a thing to him. At this moment, Aaron was lying somewhere outside the target area with laser sights and night vision goggles, and had reported in that he had a clear view of the container. Otherwise, Aaron confined himself to grunts when Falkite asked for updates on the radio. But that didn't bother him either. What Falkite did not like about the situation was that Aaron was there at all. They had no need whatsoever of a marksman. Falkite hesitated for a moment. Then he raised the walkie-talkie to his mouth. "Flash the light if you're ready, Atla." A light next to the container moved up and down. "Everyone in position," Falkite said. "We're ready to move in." Hagen nodded. "Good. Before we go into action, I would just like to have confirmation that you share my view, Falkite, that it's best to make the arrest now and not to wait for Hohl." Falkite shrugged. It would be light in 6 hours. Stankic would come out and they could arrest him with the dogs on open ground. They said Gunnar Hagen was being groomed for the job of chief super when the time came. "Seems sensible enough, yes." "Good. And that's what will be in my report. This was a joint decision, in case anyone maintains that I put the arrest forward to claim the kudos." "I don't think anyone will suspect you of that." "Good." Falkite pressed the talk button on the walkie-talkie. "Ready in 2 minutes." Hagen's and Falkite's white, frosty breath merged into the same cloud before disappearing again.
Falkite. It was the walkie-talkie. Atla. He whispered. A man just came out through the door of the container. Stand by, everyone, Falkite said, in a firm, calm voice. Expect the unexpected. Is he going out? No, he's standing still. He's... It looks like... A single shot resounded across the darkness of Oslo Fjord. Then it went still again. What the hell was that? Hagen asked. The unexpected, thought Falkite. 24. Saturday, December 20th. The Promise. It was early Saturday morning and he was still asleep. In Harry's flat, in Harry's bed, in Harry's clothes. And he was having Harry's nightmares about returning ghosts. Always about returning ghosts. There was a tiny sound, a mere scratching outside the front door. But it was more than enough. He woke up, put his hand under the pillow, and was on his feet in an instant. The freezing floor burned his bare feet as he crept into the hall. Through the wavy glass he could see the silhouette of someone. He had switched off all the lights and knew that no one could see him from the outside. The person seemed to be bending down and fidgeting with something. Couldn't he get the key in the lock? Was Harry Holm drunk? Perhaps he hadn't been traveling after all. He had been out drinking all night. He stood close to the door now and stretched out his hand for the cold metal door handle, held his breath and felt the comforting friction of the gunstock against his other palm. The person outside also seemed to be holding his breath. He hoped it didn't mean there would be unnecessary trouble. He hoped that Hall would be sensible enough to realize he had no choice. He had to take him to John Carson, or if that proved to be impossible, to bring Carson here to the flat. With his gun raised, so that it was immediately visible, he yanked open the door. The person outside gasped and retreated two paces. There was something stuck to the outside door handle, a bunch of flowers wrapped in paper and cellophane, with a large envelope glued to the paper. He recognized her at once, despite her horrified expression. "Come in here," he growled. Martina Eckhoff hesitated until he raised the gun again. He waved her into the sitting room with the barrel and followed, asked her politely to sit in the wing chair while he sat on the sofa. She dragged her eyes away from the gun and looked at him. "Sorry about the clothes," he said. "Where's Harry?" "What do you want?" she asked in English. He was surprised by her voice. It was calm, almost warm. "To get hold of Harry Hall," he said. "Where is he?"
"I don't know."
"What do you want from him?"
"Let me ask the questions. If you don't tell me where he is, I will have to shoot you. Do you understand?"
"I don't know."
"So you'll have to shoot me, if you think that will help you."
He searched for fear in her eyes, without success. Perhaps it was her pupils. There was something wrong with them.
"What are you doing here?" he said.
"I brought Harry a concert ticket.
And flowers.
Just a whim."
He seized the bag that she had set down on the table, rummaged through it until he found a wallet and a bank card. Martina Eckhoff, born in 1977. Address, Sorgen Fregatta, Oslo.
"You're Stankage," she said.
"You're the man who was on the white bus, aren't you?"
He looked at her again and she held his gaze. Then she nodded slowly.
"You're here because you want Harry to lead you to John Carson, aren't you? And now you don't know what to do, do you?"
"Shut up,"
he said, but he didn't achieve the tone he had intended. Because she was right. Everything was falling apart. They sat without speaking in the darkened room as dawn filtered through. In the end, she broke the silence.
"I can take you to John Carson."
"What?"
he said in amazement.
"I know where he is."
"Where?"
"On a farm."
"How do you know?"
"Because the Salvation Army owns the farm, and I have the list of those who use it. The police called me to check that they could have sole use of it for the next few days."
"I see. But why would you take me there?"
"Because Harry won't tell you where it is," she stated simply.
"And then you'll shoot him."
He observed her, and he realized she meant what she was saying. He nodded slowly.
"How many of them are there at the farm?"
"John, his girlfriend and a policeman."
"One policeman." A plan began to form in his mind.
"How far away is it?"
45 minutes to an hour at peak times.
"But this is the weekend," she said.
"My car's outside."
"Why are you helping me?"
"I told you.
I just want it to be over. You'll realize I'll shoot you through the head if you're bluffing. She nodded. Let's get going now, he said. At 7:14, Harry knew he was alive. He knew that because the pain could be felt in every nerve fiber, and because the hounds wanted more. He opened one eye and looked around him. Clothes were scattered all over the hotel room, but at least he was alone. His hand aimed at the glass on the bedside table and struck Lucky. Empty. He ran a finger around the bottom and licked it. Sweet. All the alcohol had evaporated. He dragged himself out of bed and took the glass into the bathroom. Avoided the mirror and filled the glass with water. Drank slowly. The hounds protested, but he held firm. Then another glass. The plane. He focused on his wrist. Where the hell was his watch? And what was the time? He had to get out, get home. One drink first. He found his trousers, put them on. Fingers felt numb and swollen. The bag, there. The toiletry bag. His shoes. Where was his cell phone, though? Gone. He dialed 9 for reception and heard the printer belching out a bill behind the receptionist, who answered Harry's question 4 times without his registering it. Harry stammered something in English he struggled to understand himself. Sorry, sir. The receptionist replied, the bar doesn't open until 3 o'clock. Do you want to check out now? Harry nodded and searched for the plane ticket in the jacket at the foot of the bed. Sir? Yes, Harry said, putting down the phone. He leaned back in bed to continue his search through his trouser pockets, but found only a Norwegian 20-kroner coin, and then remembered what had happened to his watch. When the bar was closing and it was time to settle up, he had been short a few kune, and had put a Norwegian 20-kroner coin on top of the notes and left. But before he had got as far as the door, he'd heard an angry shout and felt a stinging pain at the back of his head. He had looked down as the coin bounced around the floor and spun between his feet with a ringing noise. So he had gone back to the bar, and the barman, with a grunt, had accepted the wristwatch as final payment. Harry knew the inside pockets of his jacket were torn. He fumbled and located the ticket inside the lining, coaxed it out, and found the departure time. At that moment, there was a knock at the door. One knock at first, and then another, harder. Harry could not remember much of what had happened after the bar closed, so if the knock had anything to do with that, there was little reason to believe there was anything pleasant in store for him. On the other hand, someone may have found his cell phone. He staggered to the door and opened it a fraction of an inch.
Good morning, said the woman outside. Or maybe not?
Harry essayed a smile and leaned against the doorframe.
What do you want?
She looked even more like an English teacher now, with her hair up.
To strike a deal,
she said.
Oh? Why now and not yesterday?
Because I wanted to know what you would do after our meeting.
Whether you would meet anyone from the Croatian police, for example.
And you know that I didn't?
You were drinking in the bar until it closed. Then you tottered up to your room.
Do you have spies, too?
Come on, Hull, you've got a plane to catch.
There was a car outside waiting for them. Behind the wheel sat the barman with the prison tattoos.
To St. Stephen's, Fred,
the woman said. Step on it. His flight leaves in an hour and a half.
You know a lot about me, Harry said, and I know nothing about you.
You can call me Maria, she said.
The tower of the mighty St. Stephen's Cathedral vanished in the morning mist, sweeping over Zagreb. Maria led Harry in through the large, almost deserted central nave. They passed confessionals and a selection of saints with appurtenant prayer benches. Recorded mantra-like choral singing issued from hidden speakers, low and heavy with reverberations, presumably to stimulate contemplation. But for Harry, all it did was remind him of Muzak in some kind of Catholic supermarket. She took him into a side aisle and through a door to a small room with double prayer benches. The morning light, red and blue, streamed in through the stained glass windows. 2 candles burned on either side of Jesus Christ on the cross. In front, a waxen figure knelt with upturned face and outstretched arms in desperate supplication.
St. Thomas the Apostle, the patron saint of builders,
she explained, bowing her head and making the sign of the cross,
who wanted to die with Jesus.
Doubting Thomas, Harry thought, as she stooped over her bag, took out a small wax candle displaying a picture of a saint, lit it, and placed it in front of the apostle. Kneel, she said.
Why?
Just do as I say. With reluctance, Harry knelt down on the tatty red velvet prayer bench and placed his elbows on the slanting wooden armrail, black with sweat, grease, and tears. It was an oddly comfortable position.
Swear by the Son of God that you will keep your part of the bargain.
Harry hesitated. Then he bowed his head.
I swear,
she began.
I swear.
In the name of the Son, my Redeemer.
In the name of the Son, my Redeemer.
To do whatever is in my power to save the one they call Mali Spasite.
Harry repeated it. She sat erect.
This is where I met the client's go-between, she said. This is where he set up the job. However, let's go. This is not the place to negotiate human destinies.
Fred drove them to the large open King Tomislav Square and waited in the car while Harry and Maria found a bench. Withering blades of brown grass tried to stand, but were flattened by the cold, wet wind. A tram bell rang on the other side of the old exhibition pavilion.
I didn't see him, she said, but he sounded young.
Sounded?
He phoned Hotel International in October the first time. If there are any calls about refugees, they go through to Fred. He passed it on to me. The man told me he was calling on behalf of an anonymous person who wanted a job done in Oslo. I remember there was a lot of traffic in the background.
Public telephone.
I assume so. I told him I never do business over the phone, and never with anonymous individuals, and hung up. 2 days later he called again, and asked me to go to St. Stephen's in 3 days' time. I was given a precise time for when I was to appear, and in which confessional.
A crow landed on a branch in front of the bench, cocked its head and looked down on them gloomily.
There were lots of tourists in the church that day. I entered the confessional at the appointed time. There was a sealed envelope on the chair. I opened it. Inside were detailed instructions about where and when John Carlson was to be dispatched. An advance in dollars, way beyond our usual fee, and a suggested final figure. I was also informed that the go-between I had already spoken to on the phone would contact me to hear my answer and agree to details of the financial arrangement if I accepted. The go-between would be our sole point of contact. But for security reasons, he had not been initiated into the details of the task. Hence I was not allowed to divulge anything, under any circumstances. I took the envelope, walked out of the confessional and the church, and went back to the hotel. Half an hour later, the go-between called.
The same person who had called you from Oslo?
He didn't introduce himself, but as an ex-teacher, I tend to notice how people speak English. And this person had a very idiosyncratic accent.
And what did you talk about?
I told him we were refusing the job for 3 reasons. First of all, because we make it our principle to know why a client wants a job done. Second, for security reasons, we never let others determine the time or place. And third, because we don't work with anonymous clients.
What did he say?
He said he was responsible for making the payment, so I would have to put up with having only his identity. And he asked how much the price would have to increase for me to ignore the other objections. I answered that it was more than he could pay. So he told me how much he could pay. And I,
Harry watched her as she searched for the right English words,
was not prepared for a sum of that size.
What did he say?
$200,000. That's 15 times our standard fee.
Harry nodded slowly. So the motive wasn't that important anymore?
You don't have to understand this, Hull. But we have had a plan the whole time. When we had enough money, we would stop and move back to Vukovar. Start a new life. I knew this offer was our ticket out. This would be the last job.
So the principle of an ethical murder business had to give way? Harry asked, rummaging for his cigarettes.
Do you run ethical murder investigations, Hall?
Yes and no. You have to live.
She flashed a smile. So there's not much difference between you and me, is there?
I doubt it.
If I'm not much mistaken, you hope, as I do, that you deal only with those who deserve your attentions. Isn't that correct?
That goes without saying.
But it's not quite like that, is it? You've discovered that guilt is not as black and white as you thought
when you decided to become a policeman and redeem humankind from evil. As a rule, there's little evil, but a lot of human frailty. Many sad stories you can recognize in yourself. However, as you say, one has to live. So we start lying to those around us and to ourselves.
Harry couldn't find his lighter. If he didn't get the cigarette lit soon, he would explode. He didn't want to think about Birger Holman. Not now. There was a dry crunch as he bit through the filter. What did you say his name was? The go-betweens, that is.
You ask as though you already know, she said.
Robert Carlson, Harry said, rubbing his face hard with his palms. And he gave you the envelope with the instructions on October 12th. She raised one of her elegantly plucked eyebrows. We found his plane ticket. Harry was frozen. The wind was blowing through him as though he were a mere apparition, and on his return he unwittingly took the place of the person he had helped the sentence to death. You could kill yourself laughing, couldn't you? She did not answer. What I don't understand, Harry said, is why your son didn't abort the mission when he saw on the TV, or read in the paper, that he had in fact killed the person who was to hand over the cash. He is never told who the client is, nor what the victim's crime is, she said. It's best like that. So he can't reveal anything if he's caught. So he doesn't have to think. So he can just do the job and rely on me having made the correct judgment. Moral as well as financial? She shrugged. In this case, of course, it would have been an advantage if he had known names. The problem is that my son hasn't contacted us since the killing. I don't know why.
He doesn't dare, Harry said.
She closed her eyes, and Harry saw the muscles in her narrow face moving.
You wanted me to withdraw the operative as part of the deal, she said. Now you know it isn't possible. However, I have told you the name of the person who gave us the contract. Will you still keep your part of the deal, Harry? Will you save my boy?
Harry did not answer. The crow took off from the branch and drops of water rained down onto the gravel in front of them.
Do you think your boy would have stopped if he had known the odds were stacked against him? Harry asked.
She gave a wry smile, then shook her head gloomily.
Why not?
Because he is fearless and stubborn. He takes after his father.
Harry studied the lean woman with the erect posture and concluded he wasn't so sure about the latter.
Say goodbye to Fred. I'll take a taxi to the airport.
She examined her hands.
Do you believe in God, Harry?
No.
Yet you swore in his sight that you would save my son.
Yes,
Harry said, standing up. She remained seated and looked up at him.
Are you the kind of man who keeps his promises?
Not always.
You don't believe in God, she said, nor in your own world.
What's left, then?
He pulled his jacket around him more tightly.
Tell me what you believe in, Harry.
I believe in the next promise, he said, turning to squint down the broad avenue of weekend Sunday traffic.
People can keep a promise, even though they broke the last one. I believe in new starts. I may not have said this. He waved down a car, cruising with a blue sign. But that's why I'm in this business. In the taxi, Harry realized that he had no cash on him. He was told that there were ATMs that took Visa cards at Plesio Airport. Harry sat fingering the 20-kroner coin the whole way. Thoughts of the spinning coin on the floor of the bar and the first drink on board wrestled for supremacy. It was daylight outside when John awoke to the sound of a car turning into Östgård. He lay contemplating the ceiling. It had been a long, cold night, and he had not slept much.
Who's that?
Asked Thea, who had been fast asleep a moment ago. He could hear the anxiety in her voice.
Probably relief for the policeman, John said.
The motor died and two car doors were opened and closed. Two people then, but no voices. Silent police. From the sitting room where the policeman had set himself up, they heard a knock on the front door. Once. Twice.
Isn't he going to open up?
Thea whispered.
Shh,
John said.
Maybe he's outside. Maybe he went to the outhouse.
There was a third knock. Loud.
I'll go,
John said.
Wait,
she said.
We have to let them in,
John said. scrambling over her and putting on his clothes. He opened the sitting room door. In the ashtray on the coffee table, there was a smoking cigarette, and on the sofa a discarded blanket. Another knock. John peered out the window, but couldn't see the car. Strange. He stood in front of the door. "Who is it?" he shouted, no longer so sure of himself. "Police," said a voice from outside. John might have been mistaken, but he thought he detected an unusual accent. He jumped when there was another knock. He stretched out a trembling hand to the door handle. Then he took a deep breath and wrenched open the door. It was like being hit by a wall of water as an icy wind swept in, and the sharp, blinding light of the low morning sun made him squint at the two silhouettes on the steps. "Are you the relief?" John asked. "No," said a woman's voice he recognized. "It's over now." "It's over?" John asked in surprise, shielding his eyes with his hand. "Ah, it's you, is it?" "Yes. You can pack. We'll drive you home," she said. "Why?" She told him why. "John!" Taya shouted from the bedroom. "Just a moment," John said, leaving the door open while going in to see Taya. "Who is it?" Taya asked. "It's the one who questioned me," John said. "Todil Lee. And a guy called Lee, too, I think. They said Stankic was dead. He was shot last night." The policeman, who had kept an eye on them last night, returned from the outhouse, packed his things and left. And 10 minutes later, John swung his bag up onto his shoulder, shut the door and turned the key in the lock. He trod in his own footprints in the deep snow over to the wall of the house, counted 5 boards, and hung the key on the hook inside. Then he ran after the others to the red Golf that stood idling and snorting white exhaust fumes. He forced his way in next to Taya on the back seat. After they set off, he put his arm around her and squeezed, then leaned forward between the seats. "What did happen down at the container terminal last night?" Todil Lee, the driver, glanced across at her colleague, Ola Lee, beside her. "They say Stankic went for his weapon," Ola Lee said. "That is, the marksman from the Special Forces thought he saw that." "Didn't Stankic go for his weapon?" "Depends what you mean by weapon," Ola said, glancing at Todil Lee, who was having trouble keeping a straight face. "When they turned him over, his fly was open, and his dick was hanging out. Seemed like he was standing in the doorway taking a leak." Todil Lee, suddenly gruff, cleared her throat. "This is off the record," Ola Lee hastened to add. "But you understand that, don't you?" "Do you mean you shot him? Just like that?" Taya exclaimed in disbelief. "We didn't," Todil Lee said. "The FSK marksman did." "They think Stankic must have heard something and turned his head," Ola said, "because the bullet went in behind his ear and came out where the nose had been. Snip, snap, snout. Snout." Taya looked at John. "That must have been some ammo," Ola reflected. "Well, you'll soon see for yourself, Carlson. Miracle if you could identify the guy." "That wouldn't have been easy anyway," John said. "Yes, we heard about that," Ola said with a shake of the head. "Rubbery face and all that. Bullshit, if you ask me. But that's off the record, okay?" They drove in silence for a while.
"How are you so sure it's him?" Taya asked. "If his face is smashed to pieces, I mean."
"They recognize the jacket," Ola said. "Is that all?" Ola and Toril exchanged looks.
"No,"
Toril said. "There was dried blood on the inside of the jacket and on the piece of glass they found in the pocket. They're checking that for Halverson's blood now."
"It's over, Taya,"
John said, pulling her closer. She rested her head on his shoulder, and he inhaled the fragrance of her hair. Soon he would be asleep, for a long time. Through the front seats he saw Toril Lee's hand on the top of the steering wheel. She moved over to the right of the narrow country road when they met a small white electric car. John recognized it as the same model as the one the Salvation Army had been given by the royal family. 25. Saturday, December 20th. Forgiveness. The charts and numbers on the screen and the regular sonar beep of the EKG bestowed an illusion of control. Halverson was wearing a mask that covered mouth and nose, and what looked like a helmet on his head, which, the doctor had explained, registered changes in cerebral activity. His eyelids were dark with a network of fine blood vessels. It struck Harry that he had never seen this before. He had never seen Halvorsen with closed eyes. They were always open. The door creaked behind him. It was Beata.
"At last," she said.
"I came straight from the airport," Harry whispered. "He looks like a sleeping jet pilot." It was only when he saw Beata's strained smile that he understood how ominous the metaphor was. If his brain had not been so numb, he might have chosen a different one, or just kept his mouth shut. The reason he had been able to put up some kind of facade was that the plane between Zagreb and Oslo is in international airspace for a mere 1.5 hours, and the stewardess, with the alcohol, had seemed to serve everyone else in the plane before she noticed the light illuminated above Harry's seat. They went outside and found a sitting area at the end of the corridor.
"Anything new?" Harry asked.
Beata ran a hand across her face. "The doctor who examined Sofia Mihulyac called me late last night. He was unable to find anything apart from the bruise on her forehead, which could well have been due to a door, he thought, as Sofia had explained. He said his professional oath was a grave matter for him, but his wife had persuaded him to talk, since this concerned the investigation of such a serious case. He took a blood sample from Sofia, but it showed nothing abnormal until he had had a gut instinct. He asked for the sample to be checked for the hormone HCG. The level leaves little doubt, he says."
Beata bit her lower lip. "Interesting gut instinct," Harry said, "but I have no idea what the hormone HCG is."
"Sofia has had a recent pregnancy, Harry." Harry tried to whistle, but his mouth was too dry.
"You'd better drop by and talk to her."
"Yes, because we became such great friends last time," Beata said dryly.
"You don't need to be friends. You want to know if she was raped."
"Raped?"
"Gut instinct."
She sighed. "Okay, but there's no hurry anymore, is there?"
"What do you mean?"
"After what happened last night."
"What happened last night?"
Beata gaped at him.
"Don't you know?"
Harry shook his head.
"I left at least 4 messages on your phone."
"I lost my phone yesterday. Come on, tell me." He saw Beata swallow.
"Oh, shit," he said. "Don't say it's what I think it is."
"They shot Stankic last night. He died on the spot." Harry closed his eyes and heard Beata's voice in the distance. "Stankic made a sudden movement and, according to the report, warnings were shouted."
"Report," Harry thought. "Already."
"I'm afraid the only weapon they found was a piece of glass in the jacket pocket. There was blood on it, which the pathologist has promised will have been checked by this morning. He must have hidden the gun until it was required again. It would have been material evidence if he had been caught with it. He didn't have any papers on him either."
"Did you find anything else?"
Harry's question came as if from a machine, because his mind was elsewhere. To be precise, in St. Stephen's Cathedral.
"I swear in the name of the Son, my Redeemer."
"There was some drug paraphernalia left in one corner. Syringe, spoon, and so on. More interesting was the dog hanging from the ceiling. A black Metzner, the harbour watchman told me. Chunks had been cut off it."
"Glad to hear that,"
Harry mumbled. "What?"
"Nothing."
"That explains, as you suggested, the pieces of meat in the vomit on Göteborgata.
Anybody else take part in the action apart from Delta?"
"Not according to the report."
"Who wrote the report?"
"The officer in charge of the raid, of course. Sivert Falkeit."
"Of course."
"It's all over now, anyway."
"No, it isn't."
"You don't need to shout, Harry."
"It's not over. Where there's a prince, there's a king."
"What's up with you?" Beata's cheeks were flushed. "A contract killer is dead, and you behave as if he were a pal."
"Halvorsen," Harry thought.
She was about to say Halvorsen. He closed his eyes and saw the red flickering light inside his eyelids. Like candles, he thought, like candles in a church. He had been a boy when his mother was buried, in Åndalsnes, with a view of the mountains. That was what she had asked for on her sickbed, and they had all stood there, his father, Sis, and himself, listening to the priest talking about a person he had never known, because his father had not been able to do it, and perhaps Harry had known even then that without her they were no longer a family. Grandfather, from whom Harry had inherited his height, had leaned down with a strong smell of alcohol and said that was how it should be. Parents should die first. Harry gulped.
"I found Stankic's boss,"
he said, and she confirmed that the murder had been set up by Robert Carlson. Beata gaped at him. But it doesn't stop there, Harry said. Robert was only a go-between. There is someone hiding behind him.
Who?
Don't know. All I know is that someone can afford to pay $200,000 for a murder.
And Stankich's boss told you all this just like that?
Harry shook his head. We made a deal.
What kind of deal?
You don't want to know. Beata blinked twice in quick succession. Then she nodded. Harry watched an elderly woman stumping along on crutches and wondered whether Stankich's mother and Fred followed Norwegian newspapers on the net, whether they already knew Stankich was dead.
Halvorsen's parents are eating in the cafeteria. I'm going down to them now. Will you join me?
Harry?
What?
Sorry, I ate on the plane.
They would appreciate it. They say he talked about you with affection, like a big brother.
Harry shook his head. Later, maybe.
When she had gone, Harry went back to Halvorsen's room. He sat perched on the edge of the chair beside the bed and looked down at the pale face on the pillow. In his bag he had an unopened bottle of Jim Beam from Duty Free.
Us against the rest of the world, he whispered.
Harry snapped his fingers above Halvorsen's forehead. His middle finger hit Halvorsen hard between the eyes, but his eyelids didn't stir.
Yashin,
Harry whispered, hearing his voice thicken. His jacket banged against the bed. Harry felt inside. There was something in the lining, the missing cell phone. He was gone by the time Beata and the parents returned. John was lying on the sofa with his head in Taya's lap. She was watching an old film on TV, and as he stared up at the ceiling, John could hear Betty Davis's distinctive voice cut through his thoughts. He knew this ceiling better than his own, and if he stared hard enough, he would, in the end, see something familiar, something different from the smashed face they had shown him in the cold basement at Rikshospitalet. He had shaken his head when they asked whether this was the man he had seen in the doorway of his flat, and who later attacked the policeman with a knife. But that doesn't mean it isn't him, John had answered, and they had nodded, taken notes, and led him out.
Are you sure the police won't let you sleep in your own flat?
Taya asked.
There will be so much gossip if you stay here tonight.
It's a crime scene, John said. It's sealed until they've finished the investigation.
Sealed, she said. It sounds like a letter.
Betty Davis ran toward the younger woman, and the violins upped the volume and the drama.
What are you thinking about?
Taya asked. John didn't answer. He didn't answer that he was thinking about the moment he had lied to her when he said it was all over. It wouldn't be over until he had done what he had to do. And what he had to do was take the bull by the horns, block the enemy, be a courageous little soldier. Because now he knew. He had been standing so close to Halvorsen when he played back the message from Mats Gilstrup that he had heard the confession. The doorbell rang. She stood up as though it were a welcome interruption. It was Rikard.
Am I disturbing you?
He asked.
No, John said. I was on my way out.
John put on his outdoor clothing in the threefold silence. After closing the door behind him, he stood for a few seconds listening to the voices inside. They were whispering. Why were they whispering? Rikard sounded angry. He caught the tram to town and took the Holmenkollen line from there. Normally, with snow on the fields on the weekend, the train would have been full of cross-country skiers, but it must have been too cold for most today. He got off at the last station and observed Oslo nestling a long way below. Mats and Ranil's home was situated on a hill. John had never been there before. The gate was quite narrow and so was the drive, curving around a clump of trees, which hid most of the house from the road. The house itself was low and built in such a way that you didn't notice how big it was until you were inside and walking around. At least that was what Ranil had said. John rang, and after a few seconds, he heard a voice from a speaker he could not see.
Well, what do you know? John Carlson.
John looked at the camera over the door.
I'm in the living room.
Mads Gilstrup's voice sounded slurred, and he was chuckling.
I assume you know the way.
The door opened automatically, and John Carlson stepped into a foyer the size of his flat. Hello? He received a short, harsh echo by way of an answer. He began to walk down a hallway that he assumed would end in a living room.
Unframed canvases covered in vivid oil colors hung on the walls, and there was a particular smell that got stronger the farther he advanced. He passed a kitchen with a cooking island and a dining table surrounded by a dozen chairs. The sink was full of plates, glasses, and empty bottles of booze. There was a sickly smell of stale food and beer. John continued. Clothes lay strewn along the hallway. He peered through the door to a bathroom. There was a stench of vomit. He rounded a corner and was presented with the kind of panorama of Oslo and the fjord that he had seen when he and his father had gone for walks in Nordmarka. A screen had been set up in the middle of the room, and images from what was evidently an amateur video of a wedding rolled silently across the white canvas. The father led the bride up the aisle as she nodded and smiled to guests on both sides. The gentle hum of the projector fan was all that could be heard. Facing the screen, he saw a black, high-backed armchair and two empty, and one half-empty, bottles on the floor beside it. John announced himself with a loud cough and went closer. The chair swiveled around slowly, and John came to an abrupt halt. A man he half recognized as Mads Gilstrup was sitting in the chair. He was wearing a clean white shirt and black trousers, but he was unshaven and his face was bloated, his eyes blanched with a chalky gray film over them. In his lap was a double-barreled rifle with intricate carvings of animals on the burgundy gunstock. The way he sat, it was pointing at John.
"Do you hunt, cousin?"
Gilstrup asked gently in a hoarse, alcohol-drenched voice. John shook his head, unable to take his eyes off the rifle.
"In our family, we hunt everything," Gilstrup said. "No game too small, none too big. I think you could say that is our family motto. My father has shot everything on four legs. Every winter he travels to a country where there are animals he has not yet shot. Last year it was Paraguay, where there was said to be a rare forest puma. I am no great shakes myself, not according to father. He says I don't have the necessary cold-bloodedness. He used to say that the only animal I was capable of catching was her."
Gilstrup flicked his head toward the screen, although I suspect he thought she was the one who caught me. Gilstrup placed the rifle on the coffee table beside him and opened his palm.
"Take a seat. We're due to sign a contract with your boss, David Eckhoff, this week, transferring the properties on Jakob Olsgata, first of all. Father will thank you for recommending the sale."
"Nothing to thank me for, I'm afraid," John said, taking a seat on the black sofa. The leather was soft and ice cold. "A completely professional assessment?"
"Oh, yes. Tell me."
John swallowed. "The benefits of having money tied up in property versus the ways it could benefit the other work we do. However, other sellers might have floated the properties on the open market. We would have liked to do that too, but you drove a hard bargain and made it pretty clear that if you were making an offer for the whole property package, you would not permit an auction.
Nevertheless, it was your recommendation that swung the balance.
I considered it a good offer." Mads Gilstrup smiled.
"Bullshit. You could have got double."
John shrugged. "We might have got a bit more if we'd split up the package. But this way we save ourselves the long, arduous process of selling the properties, and the board has stressed that it trusts you with regard to rent. After all, there are a number of residents we have to consider. We wouldn't like to know what more unscrupulous purchasers would have done with them."
"The clause, freezing rents, and allowing present tenants to stay, runs for 18 months.
Trust is more important than clauses." Gilstrup leaned forward in his chair.
"That's fucking right, Carson. Do you know I knew about you and Ranhill all the time? You see, she always had these rosy cheeks after she'd been screwed, and she had them whenever your name was mentioned in the office. Did you read the Bible to her while you were fucking her? Because you know what? I think she would have liked that."
Mads Gilstrup slumped back in his chair with a brief snort of laughter, and ran a hand over the rifle on the table.